Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Friday, the 2nd of February. Our guest this hour is the author of Girls of Tender Age. Marianne Tyrone Smith is with us, and she's the author of a number of other books as well. 8 novels, as a matter of fact. She's lived all her life in Connecticut, except she was a Peace Corps volunteer. I'll ask her about that, in Cameroon for a couple years. The book is very gripping. It's won a lot of awards here. Marianne grew up in a socioeconomic class described by her father as working stiffs. Her mother was less than warm. They didn't have very much money. Her brother, and it's interesting because she takes you back to a time. Her brother was quite severely autistic and really didn't go to school and had a huge collection of World War II books, but he altered the family dynamic so that you couldn't have loud noises. You couldn't scream if you were in pain. And so she weaves in this whole story, which is very, very moving, of her life growing up in Hartford. But there's also this other event that took place, which obviously must have touched her quite deeply, and did, because she wrote this book. There's a murder that takes place just 2 doors down from where she lives, and it's a murder of a young girl who's the author's 5th grade lunch partner. And it's amazing how everything is sort of covered up about this murder, that the desk disappears from the room where she was in class. And obviously, there are, if you're a young person, you're interested in what's going on here. So part of the book is looking at this many, many years later and bringing it out into the open. So it's quite a read. We welcome phone calls for Marianne, and our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. Hi, Marianne.
Hi, thanks for having me, Kathleen.
Yeah, thanks so much for being with us. It's quite a read. This has just taken a lot of places by storm, hasn't it? Were you surprised by all of this, or do you consider this one of your best works?
I had never written a memoir. I had absolutely no idea what was going to happen. And I remember when the manuscript was available and my agent was about to try to get, foreign presses to consider the publishing rights, and they all said, oh, this is just too American. And in England, this little tiny publishing house called Allison and Busby bought the rights to the book, and last week the book was reviewed in the Times, the Telegraph, the Daily Mail, 3 other newspapers, and the Daily Mail, because there was such a response to their review, did a 2-page pictorial on Sunday with all the 1950s and before photographs from the book. So I feel very vindicated.
Oh my gosh.
It's touched so many people. I am overwhelmed by the emails that I get and the letters that I get from people, particularly women, who tell me that they've never told a soul, but they were sexually assaulted when they were children.
Oh. The other part, let's start with the part about you and your brother and your family. I kept wishing that somebody would give you a few more hugs than you had in your lifetime. It's amazing you've turned out so terrific here, but you didn't have a lot of warmth around you, did you?
Well, first of all, my brother demanded a great deal of attention because autism had not been identified yet. It hadn't been diagnosed. So we all, of course, knew something obviously was wrong. He was a savant, so he had this vast pool, one little pool of knowledge that had to do with World War II, because I guess that's when he came of age, and he had a library collection of 2,000 books by the time he died, which was about 10 years ago.
Goodness.
All having to do with the military weapons, all connected with World War II. And so we might not have I've talked to a lot of people who said they didn't do much hugging and kissing in the 50s either. But what I had with my brother was grand adventures, because in those days, you went out the door in the morning, and the rule was when the streetlights came on at night, you came in. And the huge department store in downtown Hartford, Connecticut, G. Fox, the two of us went there with my father to buy shoes or something, and my brother just grabs me, we go into the elevator, and he's just pretending that it's a B-52.
Oh, goodness.
And up we go, and down we go, and caused all sorts of commotion. And I thought this was grand fun. Mm-hmm. I was a little kid sister going on these adventures with him.
Hmm. It is remarkable when you look, and it wasn't that long ago, about how differently we treat autistic people now. I mean, he didn't go to school, did he?
He was not allowed his constitutional right to an education.
Goodness.
And my mother brought him to kindergarten on the first day, and she got a telephone call within 15 minutes saying, I can't handle this retarded child you've given me.
Mm.
And then, you know, there were programs for retarded children, and somebody determined that he was disrupting that, too. So my mother actually sent away to a correspondence school and taught him how to read and write and do his math, and it was clear this child wasn't retarded. And I tell the story of my mother bringing him to Boston Children's Hospital, which was the creme de la creme place of treatment for children. And the psychiatrist just read her the Riot Act and said, you have a child suffering from mental retardation.
Goodness.
You have to accept it, and there is nothing anybody can do. And my mother's retort was, he's 7 years old, and he's reading Arms in the Covenant by Winston Churchill.
Oh, my God.
So she was a crazy one.
Yeah.
So she had a lot. You know, when you're as burdened as my mother was, it's very hard to have time and room for the normal one.
Mm-hmm.
And that was me.
And that was you. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but my father made lots of time for me. You know, I tell this to people. You know, I meet a lot of parents of autistic kids, and they have to face up to the fact that the kids who aren't autistic in the family need just as much attention as the autistic child does. And they don't have time or the wherewithal to do the things they'd like to do with their other children, who they actually end up placing a great deal of responsibility upon. But the way my father handled it, which is brilliant, 4 days out of the year were devoted to me. And on my birthday, he would take me to New York City. We were from Hartford on the train. I could pick a friend or most usually a cousin, and he would let me pick, you know, five venues. And we would spend the day going from the Empire State Building to the Museum of Natural History. And I was all his, you know, for 18 hours. And then the summer came, and he would take me to a carnival, but all day long. And so my mother would have to require help with my brother. She could not handle my brother on her own. He was just too fast for everybody. So my memories of childhood are these jaunts with my father and my cousins. Which, you know, there really is something to quality time, Kathy.
Right. You just didn't have enough of it, though.
Well,
yeah.
Well, I came out not being a bank robber, so I must have had something.
Far from it. The other huge theme, though, that runs through here, and let's talk about it in some detail, is this repression, your repression of pain, because you can't yell out when there's this dramatic story of you're getting burned by a toaster. The first three letters of wherever are on your calf, but you can't scream out because your brother cannot listen to those sounds.
He could not tolerate. Well, autistic people, this is very common. Their senses are so tuned in that he could not tolerate noise, smells. You didn't have perfume in my house. Touch, couldn't touch him. Everything gave him a great deal of not just anxiety, but pain. And being a kid, at one point, the older he got, the more of these compulsions and obsessions, you know, grew. And all of a sudden, he announced one day that the northerly direction of the world was forbidden, and he could no longer look north. And he haunted my parents to put mirrors on all our south walls so that he could look in the mirror to look out the north window. And we would do everything. We would kowtow to all of this because if we didn't, he would start biting his wrist.
Yeah, gnawing at it. Right.
Gnawing at his wrist because the pain he gave himself physically somewhat masked the anxiety he was going through mentally. And as a child, when the north thing came along, I said, Tyler, what happens if you look north? And my brother loved me, and he trusted me, and it was very hard for him. He's very communicative. And I kept saying, but I don't understand what happened. I just kept bugging him. And finally he looked at me, and he said, because this cloud of pins flies into my face, and the pins all have a barb at the end, and I can't pull them out.
Mm, mm.
So when something would get to him that he couldn't handle, he would do something that he called rounds. And he would go through these little kind of actions over and over and to get over what he had just felt. And sometimes they would go on for hours, and he'd be interrupted, and he would have to start a day to do these rituals to remove what had just caused him so much pain or anxiety. And sometimes he would do these rituals till he dropped.
Goodness.
So we had no idea. We had no idea. And there was no help. There was
no.
What the help? The form of help came in the fact that my mother had 12 brothers and sisters. My father had 6 brothers and sisters. And the family really did what family does. They, you know, we tried to pull together, but there was no professional help. There was
right,
no
that's
one to
astounding.
Talk to.
Yeah. So what happens to you, though? Here you are, this young 4-year-old who's just had a horrible burn on your leg, and you can't cry out about this. Cry out about a lot of things.
I had to slap my hand over my mouth to keep from shouting out.
Right.
And, you know, children don't have anything to compare their lives to. So this was just something accepted. You couldn't flush the toilet until Tyler was sleeping. And I'm a little kid. That's the rule of the house. I didn't question it. You know, I just went along and did this. And, you know, there was a book not too long. I'm afraid I don't remember this book. And it was written by a man whose brother was autistic in the 50s. And somebody sent it to me. I think it might have, he might have even self-published it. But anyway, he wrote in this book that he grew up, and it wrote about how disrupted his life was. So he grows up, he gets married, he has a child, his second child. The first child is diagnosed with autism. And he's in love with the child, as every parent is in love with their children. And he says to this friend of his, "I am going to do everything I can to have a normal family. And if you see something that doesn't look normal to you, tell me about it. Because I don't want my younger child's life so destroyed and distracted that he'll have to go through what I went through," which is a whole other story. So one day the friend was visiting, and they were watching Cheers on television at night. And when everybody went to bed, his friend said to him, "You know, when you're watching a comedy on television, putting your hand over your mouth so you don't laugh out loud is not normal."
Oh, my.
And, you know, you just do these things without, you just accept them and you just go soldier on with them. And this man did, in the end, have his child institutionalized because he felt that he would, to keep him home, would deprive his other child, and they wanted to have more children, of too much of their childhood. So, but it's hard to identify because I remember my childhood being pretty happy. And we have a family friend who's a nun, and she's always saying, people always say to me, "What's it like to be a nun?" And she says to them, "What is it like not to be a nun?" Because you don't know, kind of. And as I said, you know, I think my family, especially my father, really tried to make up for what was difficult.
But eventually you do find out, right? Because you said some interesting things about language, and there wasn't a lot of free-flowing conversation in your household about what was going on in the world, or so that you could master the English language. So you found yourself, when you were older, using words or mispronouncing words, right?
Puget Sound in Washington.
Right.
I'm 20 years old.
Yes.
Because we couldn't have radio and we couldn't have television, and I was allowed to go sit in my closet with a record player when I was, you know, in junior high school and have it really, really low because Tyler couldn't stand any of those sounds. But once I reached adolescence, all hell broke loose because an autistic, well, anybody with any mental disability is still a sexual being. And so, like most families in that situation, my family isolated itself. They couldn't trust anybody to come into the house because my brother might start masturbating right in front of them. And he could not see any harm in that because, of course, it felt good.
Right.
And so I found myself more and more kind of, you're going to spend the weekend with Cousin Dee Dee, you know, and I'm all happy about that. But then when I started that drifting away, which my parents thought, not that my brother would do anything to me sexually. He was just this sexual being, and I'm his little sister, and I shouldn't be seeing these things.
Right.
When I do book clubs or readings at libraries, and of course there's such an epidemic, supposedly, of autism.
Right.
And a couple of people have come up to me quite upset and said to me that their children, their autistic children, have remained children in that regard, and that I should qualify it by saying this is not true of all autistic children. But then in studying the whole situation, psychiatrists have said to me, when an autistic child reaches puberty, we give them medication to sublimate their libido. And I have a friend who works at a school for autistic children. She's a speech pathologist. And she said, you know, when these kids start reaching 12 or 13, we have to ask them to leave because of the insurance, the liability situation. Because if you've got a 12-year-old girl who wants attention, so she takes off all her clothes and thinks it's a riot, this is a public school.
Right.
We can't keep them any longer. So that has yet to be addressed.
Uh-huh.
No one will touch it. And yes, children are lovable and wonderful, but when you've got a child menstruating from one end of the house to the other and is crying and doesn't understand it,
yes.
No one is there with the kind of advice that you need more than anything
mm-hmm.
beyond what we, you know, think of.
We're going to welcome phone calls and move into another big part of this book as well. Her fifth grade classmate, Irene, was raped and strangled in the yard behind hers. They didn't talk about it in school. Her desk was removed immediately. The Hartford Times had her picture on the front page, as Marianne writes, in her first communion dress and veil. I read it to my father. What's rape? He ripped the newspaper out of my hand and sent me to my room. Irene would never go out to play again. Now, remembering Irene's eyes, my brain shuts down. So she traces the death here and the story of Robert Malm, a former sailor who was first arrested at the age of 12 for molesting a young girl. And we'll talk with Marianne about that. Did I give you the phone number? It's 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. In Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050. 414-227-2050. Marianne Tyrone Smith is the author of Girls of Tender Age. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Marianne Tyrone Smith is our guest. Our number, if you'd like to join us, is 800-486-8655, 227-2050. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, 414-227-2050. Let's move into the other part of the Robert Malm and your classmate, Irene, who was strangled. How long did you... This is the kind of thing that would have given, it seems to me, a young person the same kind of nightmare for years and years and years and years. This is stuff that's incredibly hard to take in when you're a young kid, isn't it?
Right. Well, you know, in those days, children should be seen and not heard.
Yeah.
And when we got to school one morning, the day after our field trip to the Electric Light Company, where Irene was my lunch partner, we had a lot of fun. And we're in the schoolyard, and the older kids are whispering about her, and she's not there. And we thought she was kidnapped. So we are, for the first time, aching to get out of the schoolyard into the class so that our teacher would tell us what was going on, because our parents had in that morning. And Miss Bowie, our teacher, instead of her usual running around the room when we walked in, pinning stuff up on the bulletin board and everything, she's standing there with her arms folded across her chest, and she said to us, "Go into the cloakroom." Remember that word, cloakroom?
Sure.
Kathleen.
Sure, I do, yeah.
"Go into the cloakroom, hang up your coats, and sit at your seat." Mm. And we knew something was terrible. And we sat down, and she said, "We will not speak of Irene."
Oh, my.
End of story. In comes the janitor, takes out Irene's desk, and we're just sitting there. She is gone.
Mm.
But the idea was, and, you know, you didn't hear about it at church. You didn't hear about it from your parents, because in the 50s, you didn't complain, you didn't whine. If something bad happened, you didn't talk about it. If you didn't talk about it, it wasn't there.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the philosophy. And so here we were ordered not to speak of it, And one of my little friends who just approached me in the hallway and said to me, you know, a couple of months later, I have to go to court. Well, I knew what she was referring to, and, you know, she's looking around to see if anybody heard her. And as it turns out, which I didn't find out till I was an adult when I looked back into this crime, was that this child was one of the last people to see Irene. They were throwing rocks at a boat, and Irene's killer had dragged her under this little boat, and these group of little kids came along, were throwing rocks at it, and all of a sudden they heard this voice say, beat it.
Mm.
And so she had to go to court, too. She's 10 years old to describe this. So I think, you know, this all came about, Kathleen, when I get this telephone call from the book editor at the Hartford Courant. They're doing a literary supplement, profiles of Hartford writers, from Jupiter the slave who knew how to read and write, through the Byron Brimstone preachers of the colonial days, through Mark Twain, Harriet Beecher Stowe, up through John Gregory Dunn and Dominic Dunn, even Jack Kerouac, who lived in Hartford for a while. And then they wanted me to, as a contemporary Hartford writer, write about Hartford and how it affected me as a writer growing up in Hartford. So, you know, I wrote about my uncle who accidentally shot himself on the Colt assembly line. It was a superficial wound. But Connecticut produced more guns, has produced more guns than any other state in the Union, historically. Between the Colt Company and Winchester Arms, which people find interesting. They've come from Texas. They came from Connecticut. So, you know, I'm writing about the Great Hartford Circus Fire, which affected the whole city. And then in the end, I found myself for the first time in decades suddenly thinking of Irene. So I ended with this little paragraph about how I was a fairly successful writer. I had followed my dream. You know, I reached it, the fantasy of every English student, English major in college, and mine came true. And I couldn't help but think, what would have Irene had to offer if she'd grown up that we've been deprived of? It's just something infuriated me. So I ended my essay with that. End of story, all over, back to don't think about it. And then the book editor calls me up a week later and said, that little girl that you wrote about, Marianne, her brother is on the telephone.
Oh, my gosh.
So, yeah, oh, my God, is exactly the words that I think I... Anyway, I got on the telephone with her brother, and he said to me, I didn't think anyone remembered my sister. And he said, and there you are, actually thinking about her. And this is a miracle to me, and I feel so good about it. And he said, you know, I haven't been to her grave since I was 15 years old. I'm going to go back there today. So anyway, I hang up the phone, and then we talked about fun things, growing up in a low-income housing project. And, you know, you wanted to play baseball. You just threw your hat down, made it, you know, home plate. 25 kids appeared. There was no chauffeuring to play. You were all there. It was quite wonderful. And so I'm thinking, boy, there is a novel here. And but then I thought about it some more, and it seemed downright immoral. That if I was going to tell this story of what happened, and I didn't really know what happened, if I was going to find this out, I had to write a memoir. Now, meanwhile, while I'm thinking about all of this and working on the memoir, my editor had asked me if I would consider taking a character from a novel I wrote in, I think it was 98, called An American Killing, and making her a sleuth and starting a mystery series. And I thought, well, I love reading mysteries, but I don't know if I could write them. But anyway, that did... And, you know, it came to pass. I sat down, I wrote a mystery, I had so much fun. And I wrote three of them. They were called the Poppy Rice Mystery Series. And then this memoir stuff comes out, and I'm talking about it to my editor. And she said, you know what, Marianne, this mystery series, you've been trying to save that child through your writing. And that was exactly the case. There was a case of teenagers being killed, and my sloop saved this fifth grader who the killer realized was younger than he thought. And she manages to save her. And so I think it was true. Unconsciously, I had been going back to this. So with that, I just started writing away. I called my agent. I said, you know, I think I'm going to write a memoir. And she said something like, oh, my God, no. Because she's Frank McCourt's agent. So after Angela's ashes, this woman gets a zillion manuscripts a year in her memoir. But she said, you know, go to it. We'll see how it works out. And it just fell out of me. And I knew that it had to be more than this murder. But here I had this brother who was autistic, when no one had ever heard of it. Yeah. I had this very ethnic family that were hilarious. I mean, we had Italian food and church and doing the polka, with the, you know, all that sort of stuff. So I ended up writing this book in alternating chapters. You know, here's my life as this child in this neighborhood with my brother Tyler. And then the next chapter is, you know, maybe four paragraphs, starting with a description of Robert Mom and his making his way from where he lived as a child in California to how he ended up in my neighborhood in Hartford, Connecticut, where the paths of evil and innocence met.
Yeah. And so you had to discover everything about him, right? You were going to newspapers, you were going to transcripts of trials, et cetera.
Right. And I was fortunate enough to have lunch with the Hartford Current crime reporter at the time, who was now in his late 80s, as well as the assistant state's attorney who prosecuted Robert Malm, and Judge Wright, who actually wrote the tort book for law students called Rights Wrongs. So I sat to lunch with these two characters, and Judge Wright at the end invited me to stay Saturday night because he had a band that he now named Rights Wrongs. And he's like 92 years old. But
anyway,
it's just like writing the memoir. You write one line of a bit of a memory, and the rest starts coming to you.
Mm-hmm.
So I would just say a line to these two guys, and they started bringing it up and telling me all these incredible details. And then, of course, I find out that the Hartford Current reporter, Jerry DeMusi, his name was, attended every execution in Connecticut in the 30s, 40s, and 50s until the death penalty was abolished.
Mm-hmm.
The death penalty is back. And Connecticut, in fact, did execute a criminal last year. But anyway, he gave me the details of this execution because Robert Mom was caught and tried, and it blew me away. You just have no idea what goes on behind closed doors. So anyway, I decided to write about that and just to follow his life and mine.
Mm-hmm.
And this did not make a lot of people happy, but I think I'm very much against the death penalty. I think, you know, it's been shown that something like 80% of men on death row who have committed violent crimes were so beaten as children that they are brain damaged, that there is literally damage to their brain. And it seems to me that these people should be studied and figure out how society goes about preventing people like them from coming into existence. And I could identify with that because my brother had demons in him. And although no one ever would talk about it, we were at our summer cottage at the beach. I use the term summer cottage loosely. It was a 300 square foot shack. and you go to Long Island Sound when you live in Connecticut in the summertime. And the cottage next to us, somebody had a baby, and they put the baby in the carriage and put him outside under the tree, and the baby started suddenly out of the blue screaming, and my brother ran for a knife.
He was halfway out
the door. He was maddened.
Oh, Marianne.
So, you know, it was so horrible. It was so horrible, and, you know, The secrets, I think I tried to, in this book, really reveal a lot of secrets about human nature and about the things that families are forced to hide and deal with. And our Senator Chris Dodd, who is so wonderful, and he's running for president, he introduced legislation called Combating Autism last year, and it's passed, and it's mostly the research. And he went on Imus in the morning, and Don Imus, of course, is very much into this autism and what should be done about it. And he said to him, if you want to really understand the staggering challenge of a family with a child with autism, read this book. I tried to do that, and I did it. And hopefully it leads, you know, to the greater good.
Yeah, oh, I'm sure that'll be the case, Marianne, I'm sure. If you'd like to join us, feel free to do so. Maybe some of you have had a chance to read her book, Girls of Tender Age, just published in paperback right now, which it looks at, growing up in a working stiff family in Hartford and her extraordinary life. It weaves together stories of her brother, who was autistic savant, who was reading very complicated books about World War II when he was very young, but he was never allowed to go to school, classified as mentally retarded. And then it also weaves together this story, which she subsequently had to find out about, tracking down microfilm versions of the newspaper account of a horrible murder of a young girl who happened to be one of Marianne's classmates. So she looks at that, too, and how that event had been informing her fiction as well, and some of the other books she's written. So join us if you'd like. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050 for you to join our conversation. Marianne, you've become friends, haven't you? Then you talk about Irene's brother being on the phone. You subsequently have become friends with him.
We are great buddies. We have a real sister-brother relationship. He's heroic. What he went through during that crime was just how he could come out in one piece. I'll never know. He's just a terrific guy. He has a wonderful family. Mm. So we're very good buddies. I sort of through Fred Federwitz, I have a feeling of what it would have been like to have a normal brother. And he, of course, since I paralleled growing up with his sister, he almost can. He's taken some comfort in learning about my life, because there was no life for his sister. And I think, getting back to what you were saying earlier about, here I am in this family that most people would consider, well, that was, shall we say, outré. It was very different.
Yes,
life
it was.
When you had a brother like mine.
Right, right.
But no matter whether you had what's considered a normal family or a family like mine, suddenly in the neighborhood, a child is murdered. Everyone's life was topsy-turvy after
right.
that. It was never the same. And one of the things I mentioned is that my mother always had attached to her little Brownie camera. And so there are many black and white photographs in the book
yes.
that she took. And it was a real pain in the butt because, no matter what you were doing, it was my mother snapping a pic, make everybody stop and pose and take a picture. But, of course, these pictures are treasures to everybody now. When Irene died, was murdered, she never said anything to me about it. She stopped taking pictures.
Oh, my.
This is another thing I didn't realize until I was writing this book. I'm looking at all the boxes of photographs, and I realized they stopped.
Huh.
And I point out in the book there were only two pictures after that, and one was the following Easter Sunday in my Easter outfit, and then my cousin's wedding, and I was the flower girl. Those are the only two pictures I have. After Irene was killed. And before that, I have hundreds.
And why was that, do you think, Marianne?
Well, obviously, this affected her hugely. Here she has a child the same age. The girl's body is found in the backyard two doors from us. And it obviously just chilled her and terrified her.
Right.
Well, you know what? It wasn't so much fun taking pictures anymore.
Oh.
I think that's what it comes down to, there's all those questions you put after you've lost your parents that you could go back, wish you could go back and ask. That's probably one of them.
But what about among your friends? Because nobody at home talked about any of this. What did you do with all of this? Did your friends?
We were ordered not to talk about
it. Isn't that something?
No one said a word. You were to go about your life as if nothing happened.
Hmm.
And the only thing that broke that rule is that the class went to Irene's funeral, to the funeral mass. And even then, the mother who drove me, we had a box of crawlers, we went to the church. We didn't believe Irene was in that little white box.
Mm.
And we couldn't even ask about it.
Hmm.
And I don't think my memories are recovered memories. I think I just had been ordered not to think about anything, so I didn't. And now I freed myself to think about it. And I think about her mother. She had a black veil over her face, and I've had nightmares. This is, you know, people say to me, is this healing and cathartic? Is there closure? This wound will be opened forever. A kid is murdered. It's just not. You know what? You learn to live with it, but it'll never be fixed. There won't ever be closure to something like that.
Marianne Tyrone Smith is our guest. Her book is Girls of Tender Age. Our phone number, if you'd like to join us, maybe just enjoying the conversation, but feel free to call if you'd like. I'm sure that some of you, and let me specifically direct my request, some of you may resonate with a description of growing up with somebody in the family who was autistic back in the 50s or maybe even earlier than that, and there were no services available for these young people. And it is interesting, as Marianne said, that all of a sudden we're realizing that there are a lot of people who are autistic and have been diagnosed and they're mainstream. But back then, her brother couldn't go to school. And this whole era of things being repressed, that you don't even talk about the murder of a classmate. And what that does to you as a human being. Obviously, Marianne has a great career as a writer, but she's worked through many of those issues in the fiction that she's given us. So call 800-486-8655, 227-2050 if you're joining us in Milwaukee. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Marianne Tyrone Smith is our guest. The book is Girls of Tender Age, and join us if you'd like. Our number is 800-486-8655, 227-2050 for you to join the conversation. Tell us a little bit more about Tyler, Marianne. He was diagnosed with diabetes when he was how old?
I'd say he was in his early 50s when he realized he wasn't himself, and he was diagnosed with diabetes, which runs in my family, so it wasn't that big a surprise.
Mm-hmm.
Which meant, of course, that for the first time ever, he had services available to him. And I'll tell you, the medical community was wonderful to me. They got him into a research program where he was able to take drugs which controlled his obsessions and compulsions for the first time. I mean, these things were available to him, but there were no people available to help us.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a huge tragedy, and he did really experience some peace in the last decades of his life.
Mm. Some peace meaning what? What kind of peace?
Meaning he didn't have to run himself ragged to assuage these demons inside of him, making demands of him.
Uh-huh. And where was he living?
He was living at St. Mary's Convalescent Home in West Hartford.
Hmm.
My brother always called me sister because, and it's very common with autistics, they can't say he or she, they can't say names, and so they make up names. And my mother was Lady, and he called me sister. So when we went to St. Mary's Home, you know, people are starting to get to know him because he was there for years. And usually in a convalescent home, his nurse told me, we get people for about 8 months. That's about their lifespan once they come into this kind of care. So they had Tyler for years. So he was part of their family. They were very, very good to him. Mm. And anyway, when we had been there a couple of months, the Mother Superior of the Sisters of Mercy, who happened to be visiting this convalescent home, came up to me and she said, you know what I think is most wonderful about your brother? And I said, what? That he thinks you're a nun, too, like the rest of us. And I didn't break her heart. I said, yeah, isn't it marvelous? So there are a lot of good moments.
Yeah.
You know what? You know what I wanted to bring up to you, Kathleen? Because when you first started, you mentioned that I had been in the Peace Corps for 2 years. And this is totally outside of everything, but it's such an interesting note since you originate from Milwaukee. The greatest number of Peace Corps volunteers from any state of the Union were from Wisconsin.
Oh, I love it.
And in my group of 38, 4 of us were from Milwaukee.
No.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Isn't that something?
I think that says a lot.
Yeah, it sure does. And the anniversary is coming up. One
That's
of our listeners
right.
said March 1st, so we'll do a program.
All right.
Give us a program
Wonderful.
Idea. All right.
Wonderful.
Let's go to Debbie from Menominee. Hi, Debbie.
Hi. Sorry, I have a little bit of a frog in my throat.
Okay.
I was just going to say that although there's autism, you know, with that sort of thing, if this is the 50s and 60s, our family went through my mother having some mental health problems. And God forbid that should have gotten outside of the family. And the and as this went through, I mean, it put a lot of burdens on us. You know, we weren't, my brother and I didn't receive any counseling on the side, you know, to help us deal with what mom was going through, which I think may happen more today.
It will, yes.
And but as we have gotten older, now that my brother and I are in our 50s and 60s, the other families in the neighborhood, we found out that there was mental and verbal abuse in this one family. There was child abuse in another family. But it was like there was closets. Everybody had things shut up, but you just didn't talk about it.
Why was that? Why was that so pervasive, do you think, Marianne?
Why problems were hidden, I don't know why there was such a factor of shame during that era.
Mm-hmm.
To admit that there was something wrong was, the philosophy was no matter what goes on, you soldier on. And if you pretend it wasn't there or act as if it wasn't there, that's good for you. That was just considered good for you to act that way. So if your mother, of all people, to have your mother be mentally ill, I mean, that is, it seemed, for one thing, terribly enough, as this huge sign of weakness on someone's part, perhaps her husband, who knows. So I think if you admitted to those things, then you left yourself open to horrible, unjust criticism, which was also kind of rampant. Why that was the way that was, perhaps after the Depression and then World War II, there was some sort of, you know, kind of a joint collective psychosis or something. I don't know. I've never had that explained to me.
I
sympathize with Debbie because, you know, there is a book called The Normal One, and it talks about when there is somebody in the family who is mentally ill, how much is expected of the so-called normal members. And I do say in this book, and I wonder if Debbie thinks this is true, I was interviewed by someone from the Boston Globe, and they were the article was mental illness in the family. And the one thing that this woman discovered, this writer, was that if you had someone in your family who was suffering from any kind of mental disability, you grew up as an adult not letting crises bother you. The worst that the sky could fall on your head and you run and get the vacuum and clean it.
Oh.
You won't say, oh, my God, what is going on? You don't do that. You handle crises as if everything is, this is the way life is. And I remember being in an accident with my husband. It was very minor when we were first married. He's freaking out and, you know, is about to kill the guy that hit us. And I'm sitting there saying, well, we've got to find our insurance card.
Oh, my.
And it wasn't even, are you all right? It was, okay, let's handle it. And I pointed out one woman interviewed for this article. This is extraordinary to me. And then I feel, you know, where, you know how the saying is, it could be worse. No matter what you say, it could be worse. And this one woman, she said when she was a kid, her sister was schizophrenic. And it was very hard containing her. And the biggest problem is that her suicide attempt. And she said, I would come home from school, and my mother would say to me, you know, you got to help me clean up before dinner. Her sister had cut her wrist kitchen.
Oh, my
gosh. And there's blood everywhere. So she had to put off doing her homework while they cleaned up.
Oh, my gosh.
So she said, now if there's a crisis, everybody calls me the Rock. And that, so, it, you know, it's tough to go through that in order to have that virtue of being able to handle a crisis. But I think it's true.
Well, thanks very much for the call. Let's go next to June from Jefferson. Hi, June.
Hi. It was good to hear that last call and to hear that people who have had people with either mental illnesses or problems with other problems, mental problems in the families can handle crises. That is really good to hear. I have an autistic daughter who is 31 now, and I can't imagine how it was in the 50s. I know how it was for my daughter, especially going through her menses and after she went through that, and how devastating it was. The behavioral problems then really skyrocket.
Yeah.
And it was like day and night for her.
Mm.
She was always very, she wasn't an unmanageable child. She wasn't a problem, any problem. She was very, very, she never caused any really behavioral problems.
Right.
Before then. After then, it was really, really hard. And
yeah.
to get her to, I had to finally get her in a program in Mendota, which was really, really hard for me
yeah.
And the family. And it was, I can now see how it probably, you know, the effect on the other family members was. When I first heard you say that, you know, he picked up the knife, I'm thinking of him. You know
yeah.
how that baby crying probably was so
yeah.
horrifying for him.
It was terrible.
Because, you know, they're so sensitive to sounds and
right.
everything else. He was probably going out of his mind.
He was maddened by
yeah.
it. He was maddened
yeah.
by it.
And I'm thinking, oh, my God, that poor kid, you know, and I was going to call and say, how could you be so cruel and heartless to him? But, yeah, I can
yeah.
see
well,
how that was such a horrifying.
Yeah. Well, you know, Joan, I addressed this in my book. When Ambassador Joe Kennedy's daughter, Kathleen, reached adolescence, JFK's sister, up until then, they said she was just the most cheerful little thing, lovable, very sweet, obviously very, very slow, and was suffering from mental retardation. But big family, they have all the money in the world, they can take care of her. But when she hit 15 or 16, they could not contain her, and she would find ways of getting out of that house, where she would try to make friends with any and all boys she might come across. Until finally, Joe Kennedy made the decision, and how horrible for this father with this girl that he adores is being sexually promiscuous, and he can't do anything about it. He's tried everything, locks on the doors, she could manage. And so he had her lobotomized. And as horrible as that sounds to most people, my father would have done that in a second if he could have, because instead he turned our house into a prison, and Tyler could not leave his room except to go to the bathroom because my father was so afraid he would get out and God knows what might happen.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a huge tragedy that I hope we're finally facing up to it, and except from this call right now, I've yet to hear anybody talk about how difficult these children become when they're teenagers. And not difficult in terms of behavior, but how hard it is for them. They can't understand, their body is changing. It just totally throws them to a point where you really do need help, and I'm so glad that this caller was able to find a program for her beloved
yeah.
daughter.
Thanks very much for the call, June. Let's go to Judy from Washburn. Hi, Judy.
Hi. See, my question keeps evolving as I listen to these callers and the answers. The first thing is I grew up in the 50s, so I think we can't chastise ourselves as mothers too much, knowing that it's very easy to repeat what our mothers did in the 50s, that is locking us out of all, and our fathers, all discussion about life and change. My daughter had a best friend who was killed picking up her report card right before eighth grade graduation. Coming in from the country with her older brother driving. He was a senior.
Oh,
she was an eighth grader. And another country car had a front-end collision with him. And when we went to, killing both of them, and when we went to the funeral, the caskets were on display as we walked through, and they were both in their graduation clothes. And it was so unnerving that I started to giggle. I didn't know whether to cry or. And then later I couldn't talk to my daughter about it, and I never really did. We never learned. We never had the model for how to deal with
how to do it.
Right.
And, you know, I was a very poor student, and it was because I lived in Bedlam. There was, you know, I didn't know how to study. Because there was no quiet. There was no place to go. Because one of the things was that Tyler really liked me. He wanted to be around me. So I couldn't say to him, I have to study my spelling words if he wanted to play his version of Monopoly, which I should write an article about it because it's priceless. And, you know, and if he would demand this. And I had to give in. I was expected to give in to these demands. So, you know, when I had children of my own, oh, my God, you know, we did our homework at the dining table, and, you know, we had the dictionary and the encyclopedia and all the things I felt like I missed. You don't beat up on yourself. You kind of end up doing the best you can. And my daughter says to me now, you know, Mom, I was the last kid to tie my shoe by myself because you tried to do everything for me because no one did anything for you. That's something. Yeah. I said, I'm sorry.
Aww. You sure were a good sister. Well, thanks so much, Mary Ann. We're out of time. Mary Ann Tyrone Smith was our guest, and the book is Girls of Tender Age. Just been published in paperback now by Free Press, called one of the best books of last year. Just all kinds of rave reviews. We thank her for being with us. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the program and for on-air production in our studios in Milwaukee as well. And thanks for all of your calls, everybody. This show will repeat at 10 o'clock tonight. Copies of it, call the radio store at 800-747-7444. The program number is 22E. Have a wonderful weekend. We'll be with you again on Monday. I'm Kathleen Dunn. It's a minute before 11 on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.